Welcome to MedCast, the podcast from MedCAI, the Maryland State Medical Society. Each episode, we'll be doing a deep dive into medicine and taking an insider's view on issues facing Maryland's physicians and patients and healthcare more broadly. I'm your host, Dr. Stephen Rockauer. Today, my guest is Dr. Willarda Edwards. She is an internist in Baltimore and a member of the Board of Trustees of AMA. Welcome, Dr. Edwards.
Thank you. It's a pleasure to be here.
So glad to have you. We have a lot to talk about today. First thing I'd like to do is maybe get some of your background of where you grew up, where you went to medical school, your training, and how you got to Baltimore.
Well, I got to Baltimore by way of birth. I was born in Baltimore.
Good.
My father was in the military, in the Army. My mother was a teacher here in Baltimore. And I was born here, and we moved when I was about 11 years old to El Paso, Texas, as my father was stationed in White Sands Missile Range, close to El Paso's Fort Bliss. And I went to finished middle school, high school, and college at the University of Texas, El Paso. And when I was ready to apply for medical school, I applied to a lot of schools in Texas. And then I also applied to back in Baltimore. And that's where I decided to go. And I came back here in 73 and haven't left since then, except to visit with family and friends and the alumni that I went to college with in El Paso.
After your residency, you established a private practice?
Yes, the military, the Navy paid for medical school for me. I was blessed to have a scholarship and served my 4 years of active duty after I finished my medical school and residency in Baltimore. Did my residency at GBMC, Greater Baltimore Medical Center, and then did my active duty very close to home, down in Annapolis and over at Bethesda, 4 years of active duty with the Navy. And then I continued with the Navy by way of the Navy Reserves for a full 24 years.
Wow.
Of service.
And I sleep better knowing that you're saving our country.
Thank you. Yes, I've been one of those warriors.
And so now you're in private practice. What are the problems that come about being in private practice?
Well, I'd like to look at it not as problems, but I would like to say that after serving my time in the military, I considered that back in the 80s, as I finished my time with the Navy in 84, or active duty with the Navy, that I'd been in the world's largest HMO. And I wanted to see how the other side of the world lived in private practice of medicine. And so I started my private practice and had a lot of support from colleagues in organized medicine, as well as my church support that I had been attending for many years in Baltimore. And they were opening up a senior center and said, why don't we have you open your practice down in the rooms that we have here for several doctor's offices. And I made that my first established private practice down in the senior center. A lot of the residents were just moving into that building, so they had to move their doctor. So there was a doctor that was right downstairs. So that was the easy access to both them and me, to them as patients. So it was an opportunity to set up private practice. But I'm going to tell you, without the help of my colleagues who had finished their residency 4 years before me, and then I spent my time in the Navy, without their support, I would have been, you know, pulling my hair out in terms of how do I set this up. But many of my colleagues just opened their doors to me and the staff that I established and helped us to set up my practice, set up my billing system, do all the advertisement. I got an office manager and things just worked very well. And I kind of liked being in private practice. And even though I continued, as I said, with my reserve time with the Navy as well.
Having been in private practice myself, I know the joys and the problems that it can hold. I learned a lot of things from my older associates when I first went into practice. And then after a few years, I went off on my own and started taking in other people and having partners as well. So there's a lot of things to learn.
I had that opportunity as well.
Yeah.
Because while I was in private practice initially, all by myself, solo practice, then, as I said, because of organized medicine and also because of I joined the Alumni Association where I went to med school, University of Maryland. But one of my colleagues, an older colleague, was winding down his practice and said, let me bring you on board if you'd like to work out a partnership. And within 5 years of me being in solo practice, then I started working out a partnership with my older colleague. And I basically joined him and then took over the practice that was down in Turner Station in Maryland, which is by history, anyone that knows about Henrietta Lacks, the family of Henrietta Lacks, the Hilo cells, that was the same community that I was practicing in and seeing that family as well. It was established practice, it was established community. And we worked out a partnership and eventually he retired and I took on another partner who I've been now with for almost 30 years. We've been in partnership down in the same area in South Baltimore.
That's very good, very good. With private practice, you've had to get billing problems and learning, especially with the new COVID difficulties, you've had to change all of your practices and treatments. How has that been?
Yeah, we had a very interesting experience, and I think it's a lot of folks have had the same thing. And the fact is that when we were hit in March 2020 with COVID and having to do the shutdown, we had previously been asked by some insurers to do some telemedicine. I never felt that it was really all of that really useful. And then my patients really didn't want to do anything other than talk on the phone rather than a video conference or televisit. So we basically had a full schedule for 15 to 20 patients every day. And then within 1 week or within 1 day, we had nobody scheduled for almost 2 weeks. And in that 2 weeks, because of the help that we received from MedKai and other colleagues that helped us with moving forward, we were up within 2 weeks with a full schedule again and seeing patients by video conferencing. And we also were thankful that we were able to do audio only, because I can't tell you how many times I had many of my patients say, Dr. Edwards, I don't have a smartphone. I have a dumb phone. Or I can't do it, Dr. Edwards, unless my daughter helps me with this and she's at work. And so we were able to do audio only and still be able to see patients and maintain their health services and make sure that they still were doing all the things that they needed to do through the pandemic, even though they couldn't be physically in the office. Until we were able, after about 4 months, we were finally able in the community to be able to access PPE. And once we were able to get the PPE, then we were able to start seeing patients again in the office. Sometimes we would do things like have them stay in the car because we had to separate them out. We obviously couldn't see 2 and 3 patients in an hour. We would have to spread it out a lot more. But we were able to pick up and continue to practice well. We were happy though to get the help from the payment that was offered also during COVID. So we were able to maintain all of our employees. We have 2 MAs and 1 secretary, and none of them ever stopped a day in our office. So we were thankful for that.
Sure. The PPP loans were very, very helpful at keeping practices going.
Yes, it was a godsend.
How do you see COVID going in the future?
Yeah, I'm seeing the fact that telehealth has worked so well. I am hoping that this will continue to be a tool in our toolbox in terms of the way that we can provide care for our patients. There's so much convenience about telehealth with respect to patients being able to be seen and followed up and their preventive measures being recommended and referred and so forth, and making sure that patients get their mammograms and colonoscopies and eye exams and so forth. And now that the practices are now open, then they're also able through telehealth, regardless of whether there's bad weather outside or if they can't get their transportation, the two buses to get over to see us, or they have to arrange childcare or time off from work, or not only time off from work for the patient, but maybe even for the family of that patient that needs to get them places. So telehealth can be very, very helpful in the future is what I see. One of the disadvantages I've already mentioned of telehealth though, is the fact that they're now saying that, well, I hope that they'll let us continue to be able to see patients, new patients, whether they have been in our office or not, or within 6 months. If we can continue to do that, that would be helpful as opposed to being a disadvantage. But some people don't have broadband access in all the communities, or it's not free to them, or it's not at a low cost. If we can get those things more broadened in terms of access for broadband and technology can still be a part of the care that we provide for our patients. Those patients that don't have smartphones, we need to have them get a little bit more educated on how to use the smartphones. And then there is a barrier with respect to government. We need to get the government's approval on telehealth because right now the Office of the Budget is saying that that's an added expense for Medicare as opposed to a tangential or collaborative cost for the care that we're trying to provide. And we need to also make sure that as physicians and other healthcare professionals are using telehealth, that we provide the information that our legislators or our advocates rather will need to have in order to justify and get Medicare to recognize that telehealth should be a part of our toolkit in terms of providing quality care for our patients.
You also mentioned that magic word, Medicare.
Yes. And I was going to say, Medicare is, I say Medicare, but they're not the only insurer. But the fact is that everybody knows that whatever Medicare does, the other insurers are going to follow behind them. Or whatever Medicare doesn't do, they're going to then be able to say that they're not going to do it.
Correct. Does Medicare get reformed to allow telehealth to be better utilized in the future? Or are they going to change the payment system to get physicians paid more than 0.5% increase per year? What are the barriers there?
Yeah, I want to talk about that. But with respect to the telehealth, there is some legislation out right now to make sure that things that I talk about in terms of the barriers are taken down, that more access for broadband, and then also the better use of telemental health care. There are bills on Capitol Hill with respect to expanding that access. We found that to be a lifesaver too during COVID with respect to patients being able to access support and services for substance use as well as mental health. But on the issue of Medicare and Medicare payment, like I said, everybody follows behind what Medicare does or doesn't do or what Medicare pays for. And when it comes down to Medicare payment reform, most people don't realize how physicians have been ratcheted down with respect to the payment that they receive. I want to just kind of draw a picture for people. Imagine your household every year. This is what doctors go through. Imagine your household every year anticipating that you're going to get a 3 or 4% reduction in your paycheck at the end of the year. But the cost of living is going up with an inflation rate of say 3% or more. And then imagine that you're expecting to pay the same, you're expected to pay the same bills that you've always had to pay, plus an increase in cost with inflation. And then imagine that you've been doing this every year for 20 years and have seen others around you get as much as a 60% increase among hospitals, this is true, while you have only been able to fight and get about an 11% increase over the past 20 years. That's why Medicare reform is a major battle for physicians. And as I said, Medicare is often followed by other insurers. So this is why Medicare is emphasized right here. What we are hoping to get with respect to Medicare reform is stability and predictability that tells us that we're not going to continue to get a cut every year, and then at least tie in an inflation increase on an annual basis. I mean, we've got to also pay our staff a COLA increase, because we know that there's a cost of living increase every year, and people should be able to give that to their staff and to ourselves for that matter. But we have not been able to do that in the last 20 years or more. And then we need to right size the programs that they're talking about in terms of quality improvement programs. Some programs are costing less for you to, it costs less for you to get penalized than you are getting paid, and also that you are paying out in order to do all the reporting that's required in the Medicare MIPS programs, the quality improvement programs.
Let's take a break. We'll be back in a few moments with Dr. Willarda Edwards, a member of the board of MedCAI, the Maryland State Medical Society, and the American Medical Association. Funding for this podcast has been made possible by the Medical Mutual Liability Insurance Company of Maryland. Since 1975, they've been dedicated to providing the most aggressive defense of practices and reputations while providing affordable and comprehensive coverage. Get the insurance coverages you need to keep your medical practice safe. Visit www.mmlis.com for details. Funding for this broadcast has been made possible by iPrescribe. Toss your prescription pad. Now there's a safe and easy way to prescribe any drug from your smartphone while you're away from the office. The app also includes access to your patient's medical history, state PDMP, clinical alerts, and more. Visit iPrescribe.com to learn more. Welcome back to MedCast. We're continuing our discussion with Dr. Willarda Edwards as she discusses the AMA, MedCAI, and problems facing physicians. I just want to say, for any patients who may be listening, talking about physician payments, people may be concerned or worried about surprise billing. And that's been in the news a lot over the last 2 years or so. What are the things that physicians are advocating for in the surprise billing thing and keeping the patients out of the loop?
Well, just to give people a kind of a picture of a real quick picture of what we're talking about, surprise billing. It's not like it's your birthday, you got a surprise. We're talking about patients being told, for example, that they're going to be treated for a broken leg, and they walk into a hospital and they are looking for treatment of that broken leg. And then they find out that they think that they're going to just pay their usual $30 copay. And then they find out it's going to cost them $2,000 because it just happened to be that you walked into a facility and you saw a doctor, but the doctor was not in network, as they would say. And fortunately, with surprise billing, we had legislation that was passed last year that takes the patient out of the middle of this thing, because otherwise the patient is tussling between the insurance company and the doctor. And we never want our patients to be in the middle of any kind of discussion like that. And so with the rule that was passed, the legislation that was passed last year, we take the patients out, they pay their copay just like they expected to have to pay, and then they're done. And now it's left to the insurer and the physician to take care of addressing what other payment needs to be made when they are not in quote unquote network. So what we find is that what the legislation passed was that we were able to go to arbitration. They set up an independent arbitrator provision, which is unfortunately tipping the scale towards the insurers. For example, if we were in network, the insurer would pay us $1,000. When we're not in network, we say that the charge is $2,000. And the insurance companies are saying that, well, we're going to go with the lowest payment, the same payment we would pay somebody in network, but we're also not going to let you explain that there are extenuating circumstances, like you use the latest technology or that you use some rare resources in order to provide the care for that patient's broken leg, for example, or that you had to provide a medicine that is only available at $5,000 a pop, whatever the cost may be. But they're not giving you the opportunity to say that this is what my cost is. They're just saying, well, this is what we would pay the in-network doctor. And so you are out because we're only going to pay you $1,000 versus the $2,000 that you're charging.
The way that the government interpreted it, right, unlike the law, was to give all the strength to the insurance company, exactly, and nothing to the physician.
Exactly. And in Texas, we just had a victory. You don't mess with Texas, you know? They won their lawsuit against the government on surprise billing, plus the fact that the government wasn't allowing the usual commentary period. They won that lawsuit just recently. But that doesn't solve all the problems, because there will be an appeal of that verdict down in Texas. And there are other lawsuits against the government yet to be heard and or decided upon. So there's still a lot to be done with surprise billing, but at least we had one victory, and that was down in Texas.
Absolutely. And the way that these all these things are being fought by physicians is through organized medicine. I know you've been president of MedCAI, you're on the board of the AMA. Tell us about organized medicine and the advantages for physicians.
You know, I definitely feel very strongly about how organized medicine helps us to be able to better provide the care that we want to provide for our patients and take the government and other insurers out the middle of the care that we provide. There's nothing more, in my opinion, more sacred than the doctor-patient relationship and us working out what needs to be done for our patients and not necessarily having some insurance company tell me what I can or can't do for my patients. And I think that organized medicine really helps us to keep that voice ever present with the regulators of healthcare, as well as our legislators that want to be involved in passing laws about healthcare. And I don't think that anyone needs to be out there on their own, be a lone wolf, when they can come and work together with their colleagues. What I love most about our AMA is the fact that we have a diversity of thought and experience of all specialties, of all settings that people may have, whether they're in private practice, employed, researchers, or retiring even. We can get from their perspective of anything, and whether we're talking about internal medicine, surgery, every walk of life in terms of medicine, age, medical students, residents, all of them are all represented in our House of Delegates. And we all can bring our voices to the table when it comes down to the issues. We can see what the issues are. And it's not something, there are things that you can do just in your specialty and accomplish things. But it's wonderful to see also all specialties and all the different areas that I just mentioned in terms of the age, specialty, and work setting come together and agree on how we can support each other to do even better with providing care for our patients. That's what I think you cannot find in any place else other than our AMA, where all medical specialties are represented.
There is strength in numbers, as you know. You've heard me say before that, you know, if you're in medicine, you're in politics, and we all have to look out for each other and advocate for each other. You know, which brings us to the last point of advocacy. What kinds of things does organized medicine able to do in terms of the advocacy sphere? I know that in Maryland recently, MedCAI had a big win in negotiating with Blue Cross about contracts and who can be in the contract and what they're going to pay and what they're not.
We're talking about scope of practice.
We can talk about that as well.
Yeah. Well, scope of practice, like we said, what we did with COVID was the fact that it was a need for all hands on deck And everybody then started doing what they needed to do in order to provide care for patients. And I joke when I say that now that we're coming out of COVID, many of the doctors can hand the mops back over to the housekeeping people, but because everybody was doing what they needed to do in order to provide the best care that they could for our patients. And now we need to all go back to working within the scope of our training and our licensing. And hopefully that means that people will be more clear with respect to whether they're a doctor of philosophy or doctor of nursing or doctor of podiatry. They make a distinction so that patients know when they are actually seeing a medical doctor as opposed to a doctor of podiatry.
Yeah, the amount of training is certainly an important thing. Seeing somebody who has had just a few years of nursing school or PA school and not had the extensive training that physicians get in terms of residencies of, you know, 3 to 5 to 7 years or more, being trained by more experienced physicians to learn all the intricacies of a particular type of practice, whether it's orthopedics, internal medicine, endocrinology, infectious disease, et cetera, psychiatry. It takes a lot of time and effort to learn the nuances and some of the, at least in my idea, some of the mid-level practitioners don't have the kind of experience necessary to really practice independently.
And all of that's true. And one of the things that I think that I got out of the Navy from the beginning was the work of a team and mm-hmm. working together and how important it is to have a team of people working together, whether they're nurse practitioners, doctors of podiatry, as we've talked about, or PAs. And having that ability to work with each other creates a better atmosphere and quality care for our patients. But what we need most importantly is for people to recognize that we should, as you said, work at our skill level, the licensing and our training, and work as a team and collaborate, but not try to, I guess, as we always talk about, go beyond your scope.
Right, and know your limits. That's
the limits, exactly. As long as I don't try to do any surgery, I'm good as an internist.
Absolutely, and I'll agree with that. And I'll take you to task for something you said earlier when mm-hmm. you said somebody with a broken leg walking into the emergency room. They're not walking in.
Okay, I was just trying to get an example out there.
I understand. Let's change gears for a little bit and let's do a few other things. What would you be doing if you weren't a physician?
Wow. One thing I always heard was do what you love and what's never really worked. I love being a physician. I really do. But if I had to think about something else that I would do, it would probably be something in when I go to retirement. I like watching movies and I'd like to be a movie critic.
Ah, okay. Well,
but that's probably what I do. And I also participate or have participated in the Maryland Film Festival and worked as a volunteer there. I'd like to just do film festivals all across the country.
Okay. Oh, that's fascinating. Well, that leads me into the next question. What are you currently reading or watching or listening to?
Well, one of the things we didn't talk about is what I'm doing right now in organized medicine. And so that has my focus right now. Okay. I am running for president of RAMA. And in the next several weeks, I hope to, the election will take place. And so when it comes down to what I'm reading right now, it's mostly about medicine.
Right.
And we have 2,000 pages of resolutions and reports that everyone that is a member of the AMA House of Delegates has to review. So that's what I'm in the midst of doing so that I know what people are concerned about in their communities and their specialties. And that's what's got me mostly going now.
Yes, I can imagine that is certainly driving your attention right now.
Definitely. Just a little bit.
You talked earlier about working with one of your an older associate. Mm-hmm. What was the best advice that you've ever gotten?
Oh, part of it was what I said before, just enjoying what you're doing. He was a family medicine doctor and had been in the area for many years before I came on board. And he really, you know, I came straight out of residency into 4 years of working as a Navy doc in a place where I didn't have to build a practice at all. You know, it was because people were coming in and they were seeing me in the clinic, just like they did when I was a resident. So I never did anything in terms of knowing how to, you know, build a reputation and get people to start coming. Because every time you see a new patient when you're in private practice, you're basically interviewing. They want to see whether or not they want to see you and if you really care. He showed me how to show that to my patients. He helped me in terms of recognizing what is a good bedside manner. And I can't say thank you enough for what he did in terms of orienting this new doctor at the time to what it's like to build a practice and to have people pass the word, this person is a good doctor, this person is a good doctor, you should go down and see her. And that's what I truly got from him, was learning a good bedside manner and how to be a physician in a community where they've got choices about who they see.
Absolutely.
But when they choose to see you, then you know you're doing something right.
And what advice would you give to your younger self?
Wow. Well, one thing when I think about that is be like my mother. No one was ever a stranger to her. She would treat people as they treated her. I mean, you know, she would be friendly and take folks in and accept them for who they are. And I find that that really helps me in my day-to-day activity. And that is just being yourself and accepting people for who they are and making sure that they know that you see them and that they can see you.
Absolutely. I just want to thank you so much because, you know, as I've said in other times, you've been a mentor to me over the years going through leadership at MedKai. And I just, again, want to thank you so much for all your help.
Thank you, Steve. I appreciate that.
So I want to thank Dr. Edwards, who has been our guest here on MedCast, the podcast from MedKai, the Maryland State Medical Society. Tune in next time as we continue our conversation with leaders of medicine in Maryland and discuss the issues facing physicians and our patients. For all of us here at MedKai, I'm Dr. Stephen Rockauer. Thank you and goodbye.